911,
10-2, 2-8,
please fire ambulance.
Just to let you know who I am. Tanya's right. He's been really good.
Situated approximately 70 kilometres from Vancouver, Abbotsford stands as a bedroom community in Canada. The cityscape is marked by extensive farmlands, orchards and rolling hills that lend to its quaint rural allure. However, in 1995, Abbotsford was shaken by a brutal assault on two teenage girls who were making their way home from a party. Following the grim incident, the assailant initiated a series of unsettling phone calls to the police, forewarning of impending acts of violence. Detectives raced against the clock to identify the individual before he could make good on those threats. Abbotsford was home to 16-year-old Tanya Smith, an intelligent and amicable teenage girl whose familial bonds were exceptionally strong. Those close to her portrayed her as a warm and loyal companion to everybody. She showered affection on her younger brother, endearingly referring to him as her little baby, and she continued to use the term mommy for her mother. Tanya's passions encompassed poetry, music and art, with Christmas holding a special place in the family's heart. Every Christmas Eve, Tanya would gather at her grandparents' home to craft candies. Alongside her artistic pursuits, Tanya harboured a profound love for music, particularly for artists like U2 and Seal. As a student at Abbotsford Senior Secondary, Tanya formed a profound friendship with Misty Cockerell, her best friend. Both girls excelled in their studies, effortlessly making friends and consistently achieving high grades. On the night of October 13th, 1995, Misty and Tanya were at McDonald's, and they met up with two of their friends, Satpal Lap and Manny Neher. They were invited out to a party in suburban Surrey, but when they arrived, it turned out to just be a group of teenagers drinking near the Fraser Park. Misty and Tanya stayed for a couple of hours, and they had a few drinks, but they weren't drunk by any means. At around midnight, Sat and Manny dropped Misty and Tanya off at the Abbotsford Junior Secondary School, which wasn't too far away from where they lived. They embarked on their journey homeward, the glow of streetlights guiding their way through the night. Amidst the quiet darkness, an unforeseen presence materialized. A man emerged from the bushes, clutching tightly to a baseball bat. He firmly asked Misty and Tanya, "Do you bitches want to party?" They said no, but the man then forced them off the street and into the shadows of a nearby parking lot, the other side of the bushes. Once under the cover of darkness, the man ordered them to undress. In response, Misty courageously refused, urging the man to release them. She said that they would keep the encounter a secret, only to be met by the man snarling, "Do you think I'm stupid?" Tanya was seized by fear and found herself immobilized as she began to remove her clothing. Misty intervened, insisting that Tanya stop undressing. She was convinced that the man intended to kill them, regardless of their compliance. As Tanya tearfully removed her clothing, Misty resorted to a quick-thinking ruse, simulating an asthma attack. The man then ordered Tanya onto her hands and knees, and as he began to unbutton his pants, Misty seized this brief window of distraction and grabbed his baseball bat. Misty managed to hit the man on the back, and a brief intense struggle followed. The man prevailed due to his superior strength. Wrestling the bat from Misty's grip, he unleashed a brutal attack on her, leaving her battered and unconscious. Hours later, as consciousness gradually returned, Misty found herself isolated beside the parking lot. She had sustained a broken arm, a broken finger, and a large gash on her head. Tanya and the man were nowhere to be seen. Misty's resilience shone through despite her injuries, as she mustered the determination to reach MSA Hospital in Abbotsford, a mere few blocks away. Nurses met her in astonishment, greeted by her battered appearance, a swollen head and face, an ominous trickle of spinal fluid from her ear, and her broken arm hanging limp at her side. She was fully clothed, and she was carrying two jean jackets, but her temperature was extremely low. As two nurses rushed to her side, she collapsed in their arms. Kathy Havery, an emergency nurse, recalled, "She was quite dazed. She gave one-word answers." Misty was put on a stretcher and taken into a room so that she could be assessed. Within 30 minutes, she had completely stopped responding and needed to be rushed to Royal Columbian Hospital in Westminster for surgery. Upon her arrival, she was in a coma. Dr. Richard Chan ordered a computer scan of her brain, which revealed an extensive fracture running from the midside of her head down to the base of the skull. He also found that her brain was swelling. He estimated that she had been struck multiple times in the head with considerable force, noting that her skull was caved in at the back. It was consistent with being struck with a baseball bat. If Misty hadn't have regained consciousness and walked to the hospital, then she would eventually have died from her injuries. Misty was operated on, and she finally awoke the next morning, in a great deal of pain and confusion. In the hospital, detectives were eager to interview Misty, although she had suffered a severe head injury, sporting a sizable hole in her skull. Around 8 a.m. that same morning, approximately 15 kilometres away from the site of Tanya and Misty's assault, a man named Terry Maxwell was fishing at the Vedder River. As he cast his line, his attention was drawn to something on the riverbank. It was the lifeless body of Tanya. Acting swiftly, he contacted police, who arrived promptly and cordoned off the scene. Unbeknownst to them at the time, Tanya and Misty had been attacked together. Within a cluster of shrubbery near Tanya's body, detectives stumbled upon her bloody-soaked t-shirt, suggesting that it had been forcibly torn from her. Tanya's remains were subsequently transported to the medical examiner's office, where it was discovered that she had been struck on the head multiple times with a baseball bat. There was a bite mark to her left breast, and she had also been sexually assaulted. However, Tanya's autopsy indicated that her death had ultimately occurred by drowning in the river. Nonetheless, the pathologist noted that even without the river's involvement, the severity of her head injuries would have proven fatal. Simultaneously at the hospital, Misty had regained consciousness and was prepared to cooperate with detectives. She recounted the events involving the man who had intercepted her and Tanya as they journeyed homeward. It was the first time that detectives were able to connect the murder of Tanya with the assault of Misty. In her description, she painted a picture of a tall, lean man, standing nearly 7 feet tall, with a receding hairline, frizzy hair, a moustache, and prominent bulging eyes. The discovery of Tanya's body and Misty's recollections spurred an immediate murder and attempted murder investigation, with a dedicated team of 16 detectives assigned to the case. A public release of the man's description ensued, accompanied by a plea for anybody with potentially relevant information to come forward. Additionally, Misty's account hinted at the possibility of a tattoo on the man's arm, although she couldn't confirm this detail. In light of these developments, detectives issued a cautionary advisory to women in the area, particularly those venturing alone or in small groups during the nighttime hours. Amid intensifying efforts in the investigation, a series of unsettling phone calls inundated the police lines. Detectives held firm in their belief that the calls originated from the very killer they were chasing. By his accurate descriptions of the attack, that had not yet been disclosed to the public. He made a reference to the bite mark on Tanya's right breast, something that had never been publicly revealed.
911 emergency, Jimmy, please fire an ambulance.
Just to let you know who I am, Tanya's right there. She's been really good.
He described in great detail the location where he had left Tanya's body, and the operator had asked where he got that information from. He chillingly responded, "I'm the killer," before adding, "You guys did a real thorough job, but do you think I would be stupid enough to leave fingerprints?" Adding to the challenge, civilians manning the police communications centre had taken each call, but they were so brief that a detective couldn't get to the phone in time to correspond with the killer personally. Phone calls had all come from local payphones, and when detectives went to fingerprint them, the killer called them again.
"You think I would be stupid enough to leave fingerprints behind when I make a phone call?"
A brazen, catch-me-if-you-can demeanour came across his voice as he made threats of more violence. During one of the calls, the killer had warned, "I'm giving you the chance to try and find me. I'll be cruising around, looking for someone else."
"I'm the one. You're not giving me the chance to try and find me. I'll be cruising around, looking for someone else."
The unnerving facet of his taunting was not lost on detectives. It hinted at a disturbing satisfaction derived from the notoriety from the murder and attempted murder. This only heightened concerns of another attack, so that he could feel that same high again. Constable Ellie saw Chuck announced, "We have reason to believe this person will strike again. We want parents to keep their children in at night." The harrowing phone call struck a particularly painful chord within Tanya's family. Heather Foger, her aunt, commented, "This person is a sicko. He's a monster." After the threats from the killer came in, more detectives were assigned to investigate the case. It was imperative that they could catch whoever was responsible before he had the opportunity to strike again. The city of Abbotsford turned into a complete ghost town as nightfall descended, as people were too petrified of venturing out even in small groups. Abbotsford taxis became increasingly popular, as parents began sending their daughters to and from school in a taxi to prevent them from having to walk anywhere. A composite sketch of the killer was drawn up, and it was distributed far and wide. Some people within the community thought that the killer looked familiar, but they couldn't put a name to the face. Nav Bangle, general manager of the Park Inn Hotel, commented, "I know I've seen him before. The face looks very familiar. He's been in Abbotsford before." His comments were echoed by a bartender at the Fraser Valley Inn in downtown. He said that he had talked with other people at the hotel who said that the killer had been in the hotel before. On October 22nd, a distressing incident unfolded in southeast Vancouver. A 27-year-old woman was walking alongside her sister when a man in a worn, full-size car caught their attention. The car's loud muffler and repeated passes around them raised alarm. The man in the car honked incessantly, signalling for them to approach him. As they neared an intersection, the man abruptly parked, leapt out of his vehicle, and forcefully grabbed one of the women's arms. He shouted, demanding that she get into his car. She fought back, screaming, and managed to break free just as he attempted to drag her towards his vehicle. Later that evening, while at home, the sisters watched the news and saw a composite sketch of the man connected to the attacks on Tanya and Misty. They recognised him as the same man who had tried to abduct one of them earlier. They immediately contacted police, prompting detectives to publicly speculate that the killer had made another attempt at murder. The sister who was almost dragged into the vehicle added her voice to detective warnings for residents to stay off the streets at night, telling BCTV, "Please listen closely. He just about got me, It could be that next person who will not get away. I was one of the lucky ones. The warnings to stay indoors expanded to the entire Vancouver area, as people were warned it was too dangerous to even walk in groups. Meanwhile, more than 400 mourners packed into a local church to bid Tanya one final farewell. Her parents spoke before the crowd.
We will never hold her in our arms again on this earth, but we'll always hold her close in our hearts until we meet again.
Her boyfriend, Adam Underwood, struggled to hold back tears as he read a poem called Lost Love. It read in part, "When the sun goes down and there are friends all around, there's been a lost love. When you look up at the sky and you feel you're going to cry, there's been a lost love." After Tanya was laid to rest, the investigation continued, and a $30,000 reward for information that led to the apprehension and conviction of her killer was put forward. Widespread apprehension of the killer resurfacing gripped Abbotsford and its surrounding regions. This concern propelled the community into action, prompting a local woman to organise an event titled Taking Back the Streets. Jennifer Oliver, the organiser, shared that her decision for orchestrating the rally was to demonstrate that the killer didn't hold sway over the community's way of life. Her aspiration was for this rally to become a weekly fixture until the apprehension of the perpetrator. The community came out in droves, and Jennifer said before the crowd, "People say that one person can't make a difference, but they can." She emphasised that the rally aimed to send a clear message to the killer, raising the hurdles for his potential future victims. Commencing with a small memorial for Tanya, the event participants then undertook a walk around the nearby lake, the same location where Tanya's body was found. Mere days after the rally, on Halloween, the police received another ominous phone call from the killer. The caller placed the call from a phone booth, issuing further threats of violence. Detectives traced the call to a phone booth in Abbotsford, but by that time, the killer had already evaded capture. Nevertheless, forensic experts were able to dust the phone booth for fingerprints. Subsequent to the public revelation of the phone call, a woman came forward with crucial information. She recounted encountering a man at the sports bar where she worked on Halloween night around 8 p.m. The man sought a payphone but was informed that there wasn't one, and an alternative offer to use the bar's telephone was extended. Declining the offer, the man promptly left the bar. The barmaid disclosed that upon his departure, she recognised him as the killer. She noted that his appearance had been altered. He had shaved off his moustache and was wearing a black hat and black t-shirt. In the ensuing weeks, the community once again united for a twilight rally. Streets that were once desolate now teemed with around 300 participants, predominantly women, as they embarked on a mission to reclaim the night. On the 6th of November, detectives made the decision to unveil segments of the phone conversations made by the killer, in the hope that somebody might be able to identify his voice. As analysed by a speech specialist in Vancouver, the man seemed to have adopted an inflection pattern that diverged from his usual manner of speech. The specialist noted that his age could possibly range between 30 and 50, or somewhere in that vicinity. His speech bore the hallmarks of a standard Central North American accent, perhaps even hinting at a Canadian origin. Shortly after the release of the phone calls, around 2 a.m., another distressing incident unfolded. A lone woman was targeted and assaulted while walking along a path nestled between two apartment buildings in the city. The attacker, although unarmed, subjected her to a traumatic sexual assault before fleeing on foot into the night. The description provided by the victim aligned remarkably well with those from previous cases, leading detectives to suspect that he had once again acted upon his chilling threats. The investigation persisted with unwavering determination. On the 10th of November, detectives definitively ruled out any connection between the attempted abduction on the 19th of October in South Vancouver and the brutal murder of Tanya, along with the attempted murder of Misty. Similarly, they dismissed any link between the earlier rape case and the ongoing investigation. The sobering realization painted an even more unsettling picture. The presence of not one, but at least two violent sexual predators operating within the vicinity. Then on the 1st of December, a breakthrough emerged when detectives arrested a man named George Evenden. He was arrested on an assault charge, and detectives noticed that he looked remarkably similar to the composite sketch. They accused him of being the Abbotsford killer and denied him bail. According to some of his acquaintances, he had bragged about assaulting Misty, while another man raped Tanya. However, when George provided his DNA and bite marks, it became evident that he wasn't the killer. He accused those acquaintances of being drug addicts that were desperate to make bank on the reward fund. George was ultimately released, but his life was made a living hell from his association to the unsolved case. As the days turned into months, the momentum of the case waned, and the elusive killer seemed to vanish without leaving a trace. However, the dark narrative resumed in February of the following year. This time, the scene shifted to 85 Radio Max, a radio station in Abbotsford, where Mike Sassone, an employee, found himself at the centre of the unfolding drama. Amid his work duties, a sudden call demanded his attention. On the other end of the line was a voice instructing him to inspect the company vehicle situated within the parking lot. He recollected, "My first thought was that someone had hit our car and didn't have the nerve to tell us." The truth, however, was much more sinister. Stepping outside, the perplexing sight of a gravestone on top of their news cruiser came into sight. While the possibility of a prank initially loomed, a closer examination unveiled an unsettling truth. The gravestone on top of the news cruiser belonged to Tanya, and it had been removed from her resting place and positioned with calculated intent on the radio station's news cruiser. The gravestone bore evidence of desecration, its surface marred by crude inscriptions of profanity and threats. Among the chilling phrases were messages such as, "I'm looking for more, and I'm still out there." However, the most unsettling of them all was the unequivocal threat that read, "Misty Cockerell, you're next. I'm still looking for you." A tip swiftly reached detectives from a vigilant member of the public who had observed an older model Volkswagen van, possibly adorned in shades of blue or teal, with an assortment of colours on its side, in close proximity to Tanya's gravesite around midnight. Detectives urged the community to stay alert for this distinctive vehicle, which could potentially be linked to the killer. They also encouraged anybody who encountered it to promptly communicate their findings. In short order, another phone call reached the detectives, originating from a payphone located just two blocks away from the station, at a stadium. The voice on the opposite end of the line had grown familiar to those manning the dispatch centre. It was none other than the killer himself, who proceeded to issue yet another threat of impending violence. Responding with urgency, detectives sped towards the stadium's payphone, sirens wailing in the night, only to find that the killer had already vanished. Corporal John Scarupa offered his perspective, remarking, "As you can imagine, the boys were down there immediately. Somebody's having a good time watching from some place. Who knows where? This guy's playing games with us." The killer's recent actions underscored his continued presence within the Abbotsford vicinity. It was as if he was closely observing the detective's struggles to catch him from nearby. Engaging in a relentless game of cat and mouse, he taunted the authorities for their inability to apprehend him, seizing the psychological upper hand. It was apparent that he was prolonging the gratification derived from the crime by baiting the detectives. Mike Webster, a police psychologist, analysed the situation, affirming that the perpetrator sought to assert a form of control over detectives by showcasing his supremacy and intellect through the phone calls. Reconvening the task force, originally assembled in October to probe the murder and attempted murder, detectives regroup and extended police protection to Misty, aware of the looming threat. After her release from the hospital, she had progressed, but she still suffered from headaches, dizziness, and she had difficulty hearing in her right ear. She also reported that she was irritable at times and had a short attention span. Just a couple of days later, the killer would ramp up his chilling communication. On the 22nd of February, a disturbing incident unfolded just blocks away from the Homicide Task Force's headquarters. The Peters family became unwittingly involved as a wrench was hurled through their window, accompanied by a note from the elusive killer. Crystal Peters was at home with her 11-year-old son when the note came smashing through her window. The note was stuffed inside an envelope which read, "From the Abbey Killer, call 911. Crystal didn't touch the envelope before calling police. They arrived promptly and they examined the note. It read, "Hello, it's me. It was me that phoned from Rotary Stadium that night. You cops getting pissed off yet? Hard to catch someone who is smart, not like stupid crooks." The note then made reference to a few more of my conquests before continuing. "I told you it wasn't my first. It won't be my last either. I don't stay with the same modus operandi. I have done a few more after these ones." The killer then referenced three other sexual assaults that he had attempted to commit in the year leading up to the attack on Tanya and Misty. The note then added, "Hey, that was the same bat that was used on Misty and Tanya. Hey guys, I'm bad. I will strike again one day. I will not be caught. I will not move from Abbotsford." Included with the note were newspaper clippings about the unsolved 1985 murders of Linda Tatry, Colleen Shook, and Kim Stolberg, all of whom had been stabbed to death. Detectives diligently connected the dots, pinpointing the sexual assault cases alluded to in the note dating back to September 1994 and continuing with two more occurrences during the summer of 1995. Although these incidents had been documented at the time, the connections had escaped the detectives' grasp, as they had occurred before Tanya's tragic murder. Upon revisiting the cases, detectives uncovered a crucial lead. One survivor recalled her rapist sporting a distinctive tattoo on his forearm, an anchor encircled by a rope, perhaps accompanied by the name Jamie. Detectives released an updated composite sketch of the suspect that included an anchor tattoo on his forearm. Shortly after the wrench incident, detectives received another phone call from the killer. He queried, "How'd you like my present I gave you guys? It won't be the last." Despite extensive efforts that had already incurred a cost of $1.3 million, the investigation seemed to tread water. Descriptions of the killer, coupled with his distinct voice, were at hand. Yet the final pieces of the puzzle evaded the detective's grasp. The community's unease grew with the spectre of another potential attack. As spring break approached, students were advised to stay vigilant against the looming threat, known as the Abbotsford Killer, with recommendations including travelling in groups, staying alert during nighttime, and promptly reporting any suspicious activities. March brought further changes to the investigation, with the task force's numbers reduced from 55 officers to 35. In a professional assessment, police psychologist Mike Webster revealed that the killer was unlikely to re-engage with the authorities in the immediate future due to his fear of capture. Webster explained the internal conflict within the killer, torn between his desire for control over the police and community, and his simultaneous yearning to maintain his freedom. In early May, Tanya's parents spoke publicly for the very first time. Her mother, Gail Smith, wrote an open letter that was broadcast on regional television. She solemnly declared, "I beg you, if you suspect or know the person who committed this crime, please call. You may love this person and may not know what to do, but for the safety of all our children, please get him the help that he desperately needs and stop this happening to somebody else." Gail's words would resonate with the community, but in particular, with a mother who had been harbouring some suspicions. Terry Driver, a 31-year-old married painter and father of two, was a resident of Abbotsford. Alongside him was his wife Valerie, a credit union teller, and their children, 6-year-old Kenny and 3-year-old Anne. The family was recognised for their unassuming nature, often keeping to themselves within their quiet existence. Neighbours found them amicable, and Driver frequently fostered community bonds by hosting barbecues and sharing freshly caught fish with those nearby. Having previously served as a scout leader in Burnaby under the title Scouter Terry, Driver garnered respect from both the boys under his guidance and their parents. This aspect of his character illustrated his prowess as a capable and well-regarded leader. At a recent high school reunion, Terry Driver proudly showcased photographs of his wife and children while expressing his admiration for them. As the community grappled with the tension caused by the Abbotsford killer, Driver engaged his neighbours in discussions about the ongoing case. It was notable that Driver's father, Grant Driver, had a background as a retired Vancouver police sergeant. This connection led neighbours to speculate that Driver's keen interest in the case might be attributed to his familial ties. With police-related items adorning his house and a penchant for turning into the police scanner, Driver seemed to carry forward his father's legacy. Grant, a prominent figure in the community, had been celebrated for his acts of bravery. Notably, he had leapt into the frigid waters of English Bay in May 1979 to rescue a woman in the middle of a suicide attempt. Additionally, his line of duty had subjected him to a gunshot wound and two stabbings in the early 1980s. In Driver's school yearbook, he said that his hero was his father and that he too wanted to join the police force. After Gail pleaded for people to come forward and identify the killer, Terry Driver's mother, Audrey Teague, was conflicted. She and her other son, Don, had listened to the phone calls from the Abbotsford killer and thought they sounded remarkably similar to Terry Driver. They sat down and talked about it and ultimately decided to call detectives and give them Terry's name as a potential suspect. Terry Driver was immediately arrested, and on the 5th of May he found himself facing charges of first-degree murder in connection to Tanya's murder. Alongside this grave accusation, he was also charged with the attempted murder of Misty. As he stood in court, he positioned his arms across his chest, directing his gaze squarely at the judge, occasionally casting fleeting glances towards his father, Grant. In the public gallery, Tanya's loved ones gathered, seeking their first glimpse of the man who stood accused of killing her. The arrest of Terry Driver sent shockwaves throughout those who had known him, as the community had spent the past 6 months envisioning the killer as an obvious outsider, somebody detached from their midst. Driver's outwardly demeanour had portrayed him as a contently married man and an affectionate father to his two young children. Adding to the community's sense of bewilderment, Driver bore little resemblance to the composite sketch. He was stocky, fresh-faced, and blonde-haired, and he looked like the average guy next door. The composite sketch, conversely, depicted a slender individual with a lean face and balding reddish hair. Moreover, Driver didn't possess the described forearm tattoo. Constable Sawchuk said of the discrepancies, "A composite sketch is a guidance. It's the best tool we have based on a victim's recollection. The accuracy of such sketches can be influenced by numerous factors, including the victim's injuries and trauma, both of which Misty had experienced. The discrepancies raised concerns that detectives might have arrested the wrong person." Driver's employer, Bob Dick, was steadfast in his belief in Driver's innocence, stating to the media, "He's an excellent worker and an excellent guy. He's honest to a fault." Others who were familiar with Terry Driver echoed this sentiment. Enid Larson voiced her thoughts, stating, "We all like Terry, and I won't believe it's him who's the killer until they come up with DNA evidence to prove it." However, society often yearns for monstrous figures to be easily distinguishable. There exists a collective desire for sex killers to stand out, yet the reality is quite the opposite. These sinister characters often have a knack for seamlessly assimilating into the very fabric of our communities, adeptly camouflaging themselves as seemingly unremarkable individuals. Those who defended Terry Driver would soon come to learn that he had managed to conceal the depths of his depravity from everyone. During his childhood, Terry Driver had been diagnosed with both Tourette's syndrome and attention deficit disorder. These conditions exposed him to the harsh realities of bullying, which he later channeled into cruel acts against small animals. He took his rage out on these animals, killing them, and also engaging in petty theft during his youth. His aspiration was to follow in his father's footsteps and become a police officer, but he faced disappointment when he failed the entrance test for the force. This setback deeply affected Driver, leaving him with a sense of inadequacy and failure. As a young man, Driver frequented sex workers, a behaviour he continued even after his marriage in 1990. Although Driver had surfaced in the investigation into Tanya's murder, he had never been considered a suspect or a person of interest. He only surfaced when he was caught on detective surveillance footage of Tanya's funeral, bringing along with him his two young children. However, when Driver was eventually apprehended, he was requested to provide both fingerprints and DNA samples. During the analysis of the note attached to the wrench that had been thrown through Crystal Peters' window, an unidentified fingerprint was discovered on the adhesive side of the tape, securing the envelope to the wrench. Strikingly, when Driver's fingerprints were compared, they were a perfect match to the previously unattributed print. The evidence became even more damning when the semen found inside Tanya was found to be a complete match to Terry Driver's DNA. The revelations proved that far too often, wolves can lurk in sheep's clothing. Terry Driver was ultimately ordered to stand trial for the murder and attempted murder. As the case was making its way through the justice system, detectives working on the investigation brought Tanya a new gravestone. On the 4th of July, they gathered by her gravesite, alongside her parents Gail and Terry, to dedicate the new gravestone. The old one was secured in evidence storage and was expected to be part of the upcoming trial. Gail thanked the detectives for their unwavering support and their dedication to cracking the case. She said that their younger daughter, Kristen, was still unable to talk about Tanya's murder. As for their 4-year-old son, Brandon, all he ever talked about was his sister. Through tears, Gail said, "It's been pretty hard these past 8 months. I'm still in shock. I'm still basically numb. The hard part was it took so long. We never thought this would end." In November, Driver was charged with sexual assault, assault causing bodily harm, and aggravated assault. These charges related to the cases he had divulged in the letter attached to the wrench that he hurled through a local family's home. By the 9th of September 1997, Terry Driver's trial was set to begin before Judge Wally Opal. The proceedings were conducted without a jury in New Westminster. On that morning, the courtroom was filled with all of Tanya and Misty's loved ones. During the opening statements, Prosecutor Neil McKenzie revealed the harrowing details of the attack that claimed Tanya's life. He then informed the jury that despite Driver's not guilty plea for murder and attempted murder, he had acknowledged that his semen was discovered within Tanya's body. Moreover, Driver had confessed to making the phone calls to police following the murder. Driver's defense attorney, Glenn Orris, conceded that his client would also admit to defacing Tanya's gravestone and leaving it outside the radio station. He acknowledged that Driver confessed to writing the note attached to the wrench. However, defense attorney Orris stated that his client would testify that somebody else had committed the assault on Tanya and Misty. Driver's defense was that he merely stumbled upon Tanya's lifeless body. Testimony swiftly commenced, featuring accounts from various doctors and nurses at the hospital where Misty was treated. The two boys who had driven Tanya and Misty back to Abbotsford, Sat and Manny, also testified. They were questioned about any sexual encounters with Tanya, or if they had caused the bite mark on her breast. Both denied any involvement. On the trial's second day, the prosecution's key witness took to the stand, Misty Cockerell. She was asked to identify the man responsible for the attack on her and Tanya. Misty pointed directly at Driver, who was seated with his defense team. In response, he nervously smiled at her and then nodded. Misty proceeded to recount the attack, describing how she managed to wrestle the baseball bat from Driver's grip. She recalled that he had insulted her with derogatory language, calling her a fat bitch and telling her that she was going to die. She spoke of Tanya, describing her as the most forgiving and sweetest person she had ever known. Misty expressed her enduring sense of loss, stating, "I miss her lots still." During cross-examination, Misty acknowledged that she had been unable to positively identify Driver from a police lineup on the day he was arrested. Nevertheless, she noted that Driver had similar eyes to the man who had assaulted her and Tanya. Following court that day, Misty spoke to several reporters and touched upon the disparities between her description and Driver's appearance. She stated, "You have to see someone in person to actually recognize somebody. If he was 4'11" in real life, I'd think he was 7 feet. I think anybody looks taller when they're beating you up and scaring you." During the trial, the forensic evidence against Driver was presented, including his fingerprint on the note and his semen found inside Tanya. Driver's best friend, Cliff Scherer, next took to the stand to provide his testimony. He recounted an unsettling incident where Driver had brought his young children to Tanya's funeral, an event that had been captured on detectives' cameras. This can be a common occurrence in unsolved murders, in particular murders where the perpetrator likes to taunt the detectives. Cliff further shared that on October 14th, Driver had dialed him from his cell phone, revealing that he was by the Vetter River, surveying a crime scene cordoned off with yellow tape. He recounted Driver's words. He said he was going down there with his kids to see what was going on. This stretch of the Vetter River was familiar territory for Driver, as it was a favoured fishing spot for both him and Cliff. Cliff recalled how he and Driver had once listened to the radio together, tuning in to the killer's unsettling phone calls to the police. In a moment of eerie insight, Cliff had commented, "That voice sounds like you." Driver's reply had been swift and resolute. "No, it's not me," bringing the matter to a close. Later, George Evanston took to the stand, having previously been considered a suspect. He recounted being at home shortly after 11 p.m. on the night of the murder. The defense attempted to establish him as a potential alternative suspect, suggesting his involvement in the crime. However, no substantive evidence linked him to the attack or the subsequent community-wide terror. Following George's testimony, the prosecution concluded their case, and the defence commenced theirs. Terry Driver was called upon as a defence witness, leaving the courtroom in a state of shock with his astonishing claim. He asserted that he had chanced upon Tanya and Misty after the attack had transpired. According to Driver, he had been drawn to the scene by the sight of a man fleeing as he arrived. Expressing hesitation due to his father's former police profession, he opted against summoning help, fearing the detectives would unjustly pin the crime on him. In a harrowing twist, Driver detailed his alleged disturbing actions that night. He said that he first left the crime scene before deciding to return. He recalled, "The picture of what I had seen kept popping into my mind, particularly the picture of the naked woman lying on the ground. I decided I could go back, find where the place was, have sex with Tanya, leave, then go make an anonymous call." He claimed that he sexually assaulted Tanya, explaining how his semen had ended up inside of her. He maintained that she was alive during the assault, but had convulsed. Subsequently, he disclosed how he disposed of Tanya's body in the Vedder River, aiming to erase any evidence of the assault. He also claimed he transported Misty to a location near MSA Hospital. According to Driver, when he put Tanya in Vedder River, he believed that she was already dead. Driver's testimony was so horrific that most of Tanya's family left the courtroom in disgust. Under cross-examination, Driver refused to say that he had raped Tanya, instead saying he had sex with her. Prosecutor Madigan bluntly responded, "You raped her." Driver then shot back, "I sexually assaulted her." Driver was then asked about why he had attended Tanya's funeral, and he replied, "It was my way of thinking of dealing with what happened and to say sorry to her." He was also asked about why he had made the threatening phone calls and the letter, but he said that they were impulses he wasn't able to explain. He then later said that he was just giving the media what they wanted. On the witness stand, Driver also admitted to using a crowbar to pry up Tanya's gravestone. Testimony regarding his Tourette's syndrome was then presented. His defense team called on Dr. Mort Doran, who testified about the disorder in an effort to explain his alleged impulses to make the phone calls. Driver was also diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, and Dr. Doran said that people with such a disorder do not process information in a conventional manner. He said that they often say something before they think. Driver was a hyperactive child who often destroyed things and only slept for around 4 hours a night. When he was 8 years old, he was placed in the Children's Foundation home. Psychiatrist Roy O'Shaughnessy testified next and said that Driver's idolization of his father and his desire to be a police officer could have explained the taunting of the police. He revealed that during an interview, Driver had initially said that he acted in self-defense. Misty had said that she hit her assailant with a baseball bat. However, Driver, who was obviously anxious, then switched his story and claimed he stumbled upon the scene. Since Driver had felt like a failure because he couldn't join the police force, it was suggested that the taunting phone calls made him feel powerful. Once the testimony was complete, closing arguments were presented. Prosecutor Sean Madigan said of Driver, "This is one of the more incredible witnesses you will ever see." He said that the case was one of the worst he had ever seen, but said that it was papered over with psychological evidence. He stated, "If this man were pleading insanity, I might say, there's an idea, but he's not, and there's no evidence he's insane." Defense attorney Glenn Orris said that his client should be convicted of manslaughter instead, since he was responsible for Tanya's inadvertent death, but said that he was not the assailant and therefore not responsible. The crux of the case hinged on whether or not the judge believed Driver's claims, that he just so happened to stumble across the crime scene, sexually assault Tanya, and then throw her in Vera River to die. The judge also needed to believe the driver made the taunting phone calls, stole Tanya's gravestone, and wrote the threatening note not because he was the killer, but simply because he felt the urge to do so. He returned with a verdict the following week, and found Terry Driver guilty of first-degree murder and attempted murder. Driver was then sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for at least 25 years. In handing down the sentence, Judge Oppel stated, "I cannot find the words to accurately describe and depict your horrible crimes." He suggested that Driver had enjoyed the notoriety of being the Abbotsford killer and said he didn't believe his unusual story. He commented, "I watched you give your evidence. There did not seem to be the slightest remorse. It was extraordinary." Outside of court, Tanya's family said they were pleased with the verdict, but lamented on the impact the loss of their daughter had. Her father, Terry, stated, "I drive to the school to pick up Kristen, and it's almost across the street from where it happened. I drive past Rotary Stadium and see the phone booth where Driver made one of his phone calls. We used to go for picnics at the Vera River. If I had my way, I'd move far away from Abbotsford, but I can't do that to the kids. All their friends are here." In the aftermath of the verdict, it was announced that the $30,000 reward fund was going to Terry Driver's family for providing detectives with his name. However, there was a massive debate on whether or not they would actually receive it. Driver's mother and brother had stood by his side and claimed that he was innocent of the murder. A special committee was put together to make a decision on whether or not the reward would go to the family. Meanwhile, Driver's mother, Audrey, shared that she wished she never turned her son in at all. During an appearance on Open for Discussion, she said, "I wouldn't do it again. If I had to do it over again, I would take him to the side and I would get help for him privately." It was ultimately decided that Audrey and Dawn would share $10,000 of the reward fund. Then in May of 1998, it was announced that Terry Driver was going to stand trial on 5 sex-related charges between 1994 and 1995. He was convicted of attacking 2 women, but the jury acquitted him on charges involving a 3rd woman. The following year, prosecutors sought to have Driver declared a dangerous offender and given an indeterminate sentence. During a hearing, it was revealed that he admitted to still fantasizing about sexually assaulting unconscious women. He had also admitted to still fantasizing about sexually assaulting Tanya. Driver was ultimately declared a dangerous offender, but instead of the usual indeterminate prison sentence, his designation only lasted 15 years. Misty Cockerell went on to become a massive victim and survivor's advocate, sharing her experience during various crime awareness talks. She stated, "I can't stand the stigma of being a victim. I hate that label because some people think they're a victim for the rest of their lives." She went on to become a mother of 2 and earned a social worker diploma at UCFV. She said that one day, she hoped to learn why Driver did what he did, but unfortunately, she never got the chance. On the 23rd of August 2021, 56-year-old Terry Driver died of natural causes in prison. In the wake of his death, Misty said, "I'm not sad about it at all, but it's still a lot of shock and trying to process what's going on. This is kind of a newfound chapter of freedom. I don't have to worry about upcoming parole hearings. I don't have to worry about whether he'll be released or not and whether my family's safe. Now I know that they are, and that's a relief." Beneath the facade of a seemingly affectionate husband and devoted father to his 2 children, Terry Driver concealed a sinister side, rife with twisted and sadistic tendencies towards women. Unbeknownst to many, he had nurtured these malevolent thoughts for years, a dangerous undercurrent beneath his outward veneer. His history was marked by several attempts at sexual assault, each unsettling incident escalating in its intensity, culminating in the violent and heinous attacks on Tanya Smith and Misty Cockerell. In the end, the very individuals who had seen him as the loving figurehead were the ones who ultimately unmasked the chilling reality. The wolves can often hide in sheep's clothing. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say the biggest thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Kelsey. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way. If you'd like to check it out, the link is in the show notes, or alternatively, you can just search for Morbidology on the Patreon app or website. In exchange for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes, which includes bonus audio, videos and case files, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card along with some cool merch, which includes stickers, pins, badges, fridge magnets, keychains and t-shirts. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.